Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. Well, this broadcast will be featuring Terry Wilson, and he'll be answering your most important questions on busting largemouth bass. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Terry Wilson about busting largemouth bass. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service. They're located in Lenoir, North Carolina, at the base of Blue Ridge Mountain. They fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Their guide has over 15 years of professional experience, and in addition to their backcountry guide service for experienced anglers, they offer intensive full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So go spend a day with them in fly fishing paradise. For more information on their services, please visit www.nc-flyfishing.com. That's nc-flyfishing.com. Or call them at 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. Before we introduce Terry, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight for our drawing. And if you haven't registered yet, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Terry's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away Terry and Roxanne's largemouth bass fly sampler, 16 bass flies right from the vices of the Wilsons. So to win this, you must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and you may win those, the Wilson's largemouth bass fly sampler, 16 great bass flies right from their vices. So listen carefully, take notes, and we'll see if you win at the end of the show. Our guest tonight is Terry Wilson. Terry and his wife Roxanne have written over 200 articles for warm water species that have appeared in many national and regional magazines in the past 30 years. They are regular contributors to the Fly Fisher and staff writers for Outdoor Guide and Driftwood Outdoors. They are the authors of three books, Blue Quill Fly Fishing and Flies, Largemouth Bass Fly Fishing, Beyond the Basics, and Smallmouth Bass Fly Fishing, A Practical Guide. They are the creators of many warm water flies, including bullies, bluegill, spider. Terry and Roxanne are also affiliated with Whiting, Reddington, Sage, and Rio. Terry is the president of the Tri-Lakes Fly Fishers, and both the Wilsons serve on the board of Missouri Outdoor Communicators. Their newest flies can be seen at thebluegillpond.com, thebluegillpond.com. So, Terry, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. It's good to have you back.
Well, thank you, Roger. Certainly my pleasure to join you again. We're going to talk about an exciting topic tonight, largemouth bass, one of my very favorites.
Yeah, mine too, because the first fish I ever caught on a fly was a largemouth bass in a local farmer's pond. So it has long, long memories for me.
Absolutely.
You know, wading out in the summer pond up to our chests with just our shorts and T-shirts on, you know, no gear, and fly fishing for largemouth bass, so. Yeah, lots of good memories there.
Hard to beat.
Since then, that they bulldozed the pond, filled it up with dirt, and built houses on top of it. So that's the sad part.
You bet.
But plenty of other places to fish for them, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, let's dig in and let's talk about largemouth bass. So Well, you said it's one of your favorite warm water species. Tell us about that. Why is it?
Well, I think it's certainly different from any other type of fly fishing you're apt to do. It's nothing at all like throwing a little tuft of feathers out and hoping a brightly colored fish will come along and slurp it off the top. You're talking about an ambush predator, and I think the most endearing quality is that however you catch him, wherever you catch him, he wants to fight at the surface and sometimes above it, and that can be very, very exciting. And he'll eat almost anything because of that cavernous mouth. And so, you know, we've learned to adapt and throw some things that are on his menu, and it's great fun.
Yeah, I always love that explosive action on the surface. I think that's one of many bass fishermen's delights, is to watch that. I mean, you never tire of that because, like you say, they are aggressive. They don't mess around. When they want to eat something, they eat it.
That's right.
And, you know, no pate for them, right? It's all steak and potatoes. So.
Meat and potatoes, you bet.
Yeah. So how do they, I know you're a big smallmouth bass fisherman as well. How do they differ from smallmouth in character and maybe where you fish for them and your approach?
Well, of course, in terms of taxonomy, it's all about that lower jaw. The largemouth bass's jaw extends beyond its eye, whereas a smallmouth extends to the front of the eye, and that actually makes quite a large difference in the size of the mouth. But in terms of behavior, smallmouth prefer moving water. They like rock structure in particular, whereas a largemouth bass is going to shy away from that moving water as much as possible. They want it still, and they will relate to weeds, down timber, steep drop-offs, stumps, vegetation, all different kinds of, maybe even under a dock, anything that's man-made that provides shade and overhead cover. So they're two very, very different species that don't really interfere one with the other. We have lakes and rivers here in the area where both occupy the environment, and they are not really competing with one another. Some food sources, of course, but other than that, they stay pretty clear of one another.
Okay. So now, do you find largemouth in streams or rivers, or are they only in still water?
No, here certainly we have lots of rivers, slow-moving rivers, or slow-moving sections of rivers where largemouth are found. You can actually catch each species from the same pool and on the same trip. A little bit unusual in that respect, but a little different water, a little different presentation. But, yes, the largemouth bass do occupy the rivers as well.
Okay. So you said they like the slow-moving or still water best, and you pretty much described the kinds of structure and so forth. What about water temperature? Is there a time of year when they're more active? Is there a time of year when you don't even fish for them?
Well, I guess in this latitude, yes, that's probably the case. I start looking for spring largemouth when the water temperature at a depth of, say, 3 to 4 feet reaches the upper 40-degree range. It improves right along, and maybe as it reaches the spawn. A lot of people think that their first movements in the spring to shallow water is to spawn, and that's not true. What they're actually doing is following their prey species into the shallows, and they'll feed quite heavily. And so that's why some of the better fish that you may catch in the entire year are caught when those temperatures are still pretty cool. And I think that, you know, depending on geography to a major extent, somewhere between 85 and 90 degrees starts to become somewhat debilitating for largemouth bass. So if I had to pick the ideal temperature, I would say something on the order of 70 to 75 would be ideal.
Okay. Does that mean in the summertime when you get those high ambient temperatures that fishing is better in the morning and the evening?
Yes, absolutely. And really they are a species that is very dependent on the sunlight penetration. Their eyes are on top of their head. Of course, there's no way for their eye to adjust like yours and mine to any kind of change in intensity of light. And so their reaction to that is to move up and down the water column to make sure that their eyes are protected and they can see well.
Mm-hmm. I remember fishing for them until we couldn't see anymore, and they were still doing fine, after dusk, feeding at night. So they must do some nocturnal feeding, right?
Oh, yes. I think that they do, particularly during the heat of the summer, if you have a period of really, really intense heat, then early morning is best, and I mean even before the sun comes up. And the reason for that is that the water has cooled to whatever extent that it's going to over the course of the dark hours. And then in those early morning hours, when the surface is the coolest, those bass will be most active.
Okay. So that's why my dad drugged me out 4 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah,
I remember that, too. Yeah. He's a big bass fisherman coming from, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to teach him about trout. But he was always, okay, we got to get up very early and make the sandwiches the night before. And we don't waste any time because the boat's got to be on the water at daybreak,
That's right.
So he had a plan. Okay, let's talk. There were some questions about equipment. Chris in Ontario, Canada, he says, he wrote in, I'm just getting into fly fishing and will be doing most of my fishing at my cottage on a lake for bass and panfish. So he should listen to the crappie show, too. Maybe he'll, he's got some crappie up there. Can you give me some tips on rods and line to use for lake fishing?
Oh, sure. Chris, thanks for that question. Let me say that if you're fishing for panfish and you're targeting, let's say, bluegill or crappie, I would be hard-pressed to beat a 3 or 4 weight rod. I wish I knew a little bit more about your lake, but if you are fishing bass, then that has to go up to probably a 7 or 8 weight. Because it's really dependent upon the size and weight and wind resistance of the flies that you're trying to that you're going to throw, and I think those two extremes would probably do the best for you. Having said that, if you are confined to one rod, I would recommend, and this may seem a little bit unusual, but I would recommend 7 weight. And the reason is that you can fish smaller and lighter with that 7 weight and yet throw some pretty large and wind-resistant bugs for the bigger bass. So those would be my recommendations on rods. On lines, there are some new floating lines out that don't have any give to them. They're very, very strong, and consequently when you set the hook, you get an immediate hook set, and I really like those. Rio has one, for example. The Rio Gold series that I like really, really well. And in addition, you might be interested, again, I don't know anything about your lake in particular, but you might want to look into an intermediate line, perhaps one that sinks at 1 to 2 inches per second. If you are encountering wind, that will help you beat it because the line will get below that wave action and you won't create a lot of slack. And it'll also enable you to get down a little bit and yet keep your fly above the bottom or any kind of entanglements that you might be fishing over.
So you mentioned floating and intermediate sinking. Does it ever make sense to use sinking tip or sinking line?
Yes, and both, actually. If you stop and think about it, a sink tip line that has any kind of floating section, when you strip it, what happens is that the fly comes on an angle back toward the rod tip. Now, that may be a good thing, because if you then release the tension, it drops back to bottom, and you've got kind of a hopping action to it, which can certainly trigger strikes. But if you wanted to fish, let's say, a crayfish pattern, and you wanted to keep that crayfish pattern in contact with the bottom, then a full sinking line is going to perform much better for you, because it'll be right along the bottom, and as you strip it, the fly is going to stay right down there, maybe even create a little silk trail, and that, you know, is like the natural also.
Okay. What do you usually use when you're fishing with streamers?
Recently, I would have to say that the intermediate lines, once again, if you are on bigger water or wind-blown water, it gets it below that little wave action. And yet, it doesn't sink so fast that it's going to get down and hook up on structure quite as easily. So, particularly for streamer fishing, I really like those intermediate lines.
Okay. Now, what about leader and tippet setup? Are bass leader shy at all? Or?
No, not at all, really, I've got to say. And I, having said that, you certainly don't want sloppy casts or banging on the boat or any of that kind of thing. But they certainly aren't leader shy, because they're a species with that cavernous mouth that may take, my goodness, they may take a baby alligator. They may take a bird, a baby bird that's fallen out of the nest. So anything that's willing to attack that as an ambush predator is probably not terribly leader shy, and I find that to be the case with largemouth bass. I would say my most common setup for largemouth is with floating line, in particular, 7.5 foot leader. Nothing wrong with a 9, actually, but I prefer the 7.5. And the tippets might run anywhere from 4X to 16 pound. If you're using a sinking line or a sink tip line, I'll cut the butt section of that leader back to 3.5 to 4 foot leader, still tapered, so that the fly won't bow back up toward the surface. So it really is dependent on what you're throwing and where you want to present that fly, but certainly nothing wrong with fishing for bass with a 5-weight and 4X tippet. But you're pretty much confined to size 6, size 8 flies. If you're going to throw, let's say, a deer hair pattern, maybe a 1-aught, and you're throwing it on an 8-weight, for example, you're going to need a pretty heavy tippet to turn that fly over and land it quietly on the water.
So going to the, the 7-8-weight rods and line setups, you're doing that more for presentation of the larger, very wind-resistant flies rather than needing the rod to bite the fish.
Yes. Right. Yes, that's absolutely right.
Okay. Yeah, I got you there. And you mentioned, and I just want to kind of talk about that a bit more, when you said you were doing, when you were fishing underwater with streamers and so forth, you shortened up your leader. And I've heard that before because, like you said, it bowing to the top, the closer it is to the line, then the more straight line you have between you and the fly.
That's right.
To make sure it stays at the same level, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise
yeah.
It could be, your line could be 5 feet deep and your fly could be, 2 feet deep.
Yeah, that's right. That's
yeah,
right.
You're really kind of fooling yourself. Yeah. So
yeah.
I thought that was kind of an important point that sometimes we don't think about.
I agree.
Well, let's take a quick break, Terry. When we come back, we'll talk more about fishing for largemouth bass. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Terry Wilson about busting largemouth bass. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Terry, I was asking my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world, so what is going on with you and Roxanne?
Well, Roger, we've been very, very busy starting in February. We've done three major shows so far, the Hawkeye Fly Fishing Convention up in Iowa, which is a statewide event. Great deal of fun up there, and we've also done one in Oklahoma and one in Arkansas. We've kept up with our regular writing, and of course we've been tying flies and working our website, which is www.thebluegillpond.com. And on the website we carry our books and our flies, and there's also articles and a tip section, even a cartoon section. And my brother, who is a wildlife artist from Iowa, does all of our illustrations, and he does the cartoons. And I want people, when they see those cartoons, to realize that all of the stupid things that he is cartooning, I modeled those things. I've already done that.
So it's your life story being illustrated.
I'm afraid it is, actually.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I'm going to have to go look at that. I should have looked at that before I asked you to come on the show.
There you go.
I don't know what I'm going to find over there. All right. Well, Roxanne's still married to you, right? So it can't
yes,
all be
yes.
That. So, good. Well, so you're doing shows where you do presentations at the shows? Is that what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And most of them kind of follow along our book. We have... I think seven shows right now that we're constantly upgrading and improving them and adding new photos and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's very fun because you're out there actually talking to the people and you get some very interesting questions just like on your show, and you learn a lot in the process, and it's fun.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm assuming you have your books on your website as well.
Yes.
One thing that Terry did tell me, folks, is that the their book on largemouth bass is at the moment out of print. Amato is the publisher, and they may be bringing it back into print. And maybe if you call Amato Books, they're one of our sponsors too, and kind of urge them on, maybe they'll get that book back on the shelves again. So call Amato and request it, and see if you can't rattle their cage a little bit over there.
You bet.
Yeah, and that might help them, inspire them to get on the move with that. So, okay, good. Well, let's get back to our questions. There was one specific question from Boris in Ohio about a switch rod. He says he's got 11-foot-6 weight switch rod. Could he use that for largemouth bass? Does a switch rod offer any kind of advantage or?
I can think of an instance or two where it would offer an advantage. Certainly, the answer to the question, as far as I would be concerned, would be yes, but I would be very quick to say, but most of the time, the advantage of a switch rod is that you can really reach out and throw some long lines. And if you are stationary, let's say you're a shore-bound fisherman, you're maybe on a little dock, and the far corner of the pond can be reached with that switch rod, I think that would be certainly an advantage. However, most of the casting that we do for largemouth bass are short casts, 25, 30, 35 feet, something like that. And accuracy is much, much more important than the length of the fly, the length of the cast, rather. So... Yeah, you can make that work for you, certainly. It certainly would not be my first choice, let's put it that way.
Okay. Let's talk then about food and flies. First of all, you'd mentioned a few things that bass feed on. What is their main food source?
Well, I think that by and large they are very opportunistic feeders, and they will feed on anything from insects, subaquatic and adult, hoppers, baby birds, baby alligators, minnows, shad, even their own young. So, you know, I mean, the menu is wide open. I think that they will obviously feed most heavily, depending on the water that they're found in and what's available to them, on a particular species. For example, a lot of the lakes in our area, the big reservoirs, have shad populations, and they feed very heavily on shad. And there are times when that, you know, you better fish a shad imitation or forget about it. But like I say, often a largemouth bass is really an opportunistic feeder. One of the unusual things I think about a largemouth bass is that their preference, as a pretty lazy critter, is to eat one very large meal and then find a very comfortable lie and lay there and look out at the world for the next 4 or 5 days digesting that meal before they have to hunt again. What that means for the angler is that we don't really have a huge window of opportunity to catch, you know, the larger ones of the species. But it also tells us that large food is going to attract large bass, and I think that that's obviously a truism as well.
Well, you know, we talk about that a lot in trout fishing. You know, we are always asked, does bigger flies mean bigger fish? And with trout, that's not necessarily the case.
That's right.
Because you can have a 10-pound trout sipping midge larva, you know. It's like, seems totally ridiculous, but that's what they do. So is that less the case than the bass?
I think that it's very much less the case. I think that they have a chance to feed on that one big item and then not feed again for 4 or 5 days, that's certainly the lifestyle that they're going to try to live. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, you had mentioned crayfish before, so that's one of the, I would think, a pretty decent sized source of food for them.
It is a very large source of food, and part of the reason for that is that crayfish are very prolific. They reproduce rapidly. They grow through stages where they outgrow their exoskeleton and have to grow another as they grow. And also, they're very, very poor swimmers, so they can't really get away very well. Their only defense is to flap that tail and to swim backwards for a couple of feet, and then they're back down to the bottom. So they're easy for the largemouth to track and to gobble up.
Is that something you fish a lot as a fly?
I would say that I fish it more often for smallmouth bass than I do largemouth. But certainly, yes, I do fish it. I do fish it for largemouth as well.
When are there any particular techniques you use for fishing crayfish?
Well, I like, and we've talked about this also earlier, I like that lift-drop strip retrieve. In other words, as I remove the slack from my line and point the rod tip directly at the fly, and then lift the rod tip by 6 inches, 8 inches, whatever, and then drop it back down to the original position, what has happened is that fly has bounced off of the bottom for a few inches and now gone back down and made bottom contact again. And then I strip only to remove the slack and then repeat the process. So, you know, and some people, particularly smallmouth fishermen, have called that the crayfish hop. But it, I call it the strip, lift drop strip retrieve. And I think that that's excellent whenever you're using a crayfish pattern, whether it's in still water or in moving water.
Okay. Boris in Ohio wrote and asked several questions about flies, so let's march through Boris's questions. First of all, he asked about weed guard, and also Phil McCartney from California Online was asking about weed guards. So tell us, give us the whole story on weed guards.
Okay. Well, of course, there are many different kinds and options. Most common, of course, the most commonly used, I suppose, is monofilament weed guard. And for those that tie their own, I would certainly suggest Mason Hard Mono as being one good source of monofilament for weed guards. And that can either be as a single weed guard or as a double. We have the double on our rattle worm that we sell on our website. And for most of our other patterns, Bass Bully, for example, comes with a single mono weed guard. Now, having said all of that, we really like a product that's called Stick Guard. And this is such a simple idea. I really wished I had thought of it. And it's one of those you kind of hit yourself in the head and say, why didn't I think of this? It's simply a clear plastic worm that is flat on one end with a slit in that end. And to the finished fly, before you tie it on to your tippet, you slip that little slit through the eye of the hook. And then you take the other end, which is blunt, and stick it right into the hook point. And you have an absolutely foolproof weed guard system that is just as good as that of the plastic worm guys that are throwing with the hardware. So that product, and frankly, I've not seen that product in fly shops as yet. I'm surprised by that. Bass Pro Shop shops and other retail outlets do carry that in their conventional tackle aisle, but it works perfect on flies, and it comes in a couple of different sizes and very, very inexpensive. So that's certainly something that guys that are having problems with weed guards, you know, might take a real serious look at.
Okay, another question from Boris. Have you used tube fly poppers, and if so, what do you think of them?
Well, actually, Boris, I have not used tube fly poppers, but I think that the action on them is wonderful. I would certainly think that they would work very, very well, and the only excuse that I can give for not using them is that I'm old school. I guess that would have to be my excuse. But yeah, they look very good, and I'm sure that they would work terrific. But no, I have not used those.
Yeah, well, with the selection of flies that I can see on your site, probably covered most of the bases here. So, yeah, I can see, why mess with success when the selection you have here. This Wilson's jointed Sally is really quite the contraption, it looks like.
Yes. I'll tell you, that looks like a deep water fly. And in the summertime, it works just fine. If you're fishing a deep drop-off and you cast it and let it wiggle head first down, the tail is wiggling and the body wiggles because it's an articulated fly, works just fine. But the reason that we came up with that is to fish during the spawn, or actually during the pre-spawn, because as those male bass are building their nest, they become increasingly territorial, and they have a relationship with salamanders kind of like a crow and an owl. You know, it's just an intense hatred. And the reason for it is that salamanders are egg stealers. And so bass hit them tremendously hard to kill them. and get them out of their nest. And we use those on full sinking line in the spring. We'll probably start that in another 3 weeks or so here, 2 to 3 weeks maybe, depending on weather. And we'll pull those right through the bass bed and get some vicious strikes. So that's kind of the history of that fly.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And very practical as well. A specific purpose for that fly. That's incredible. Yeah. Any other of the flies that have their own stories that you've developed?
Well, those people who have a copy of our largemouth book will find a fly in there called Bass Bully. And we still tie a bass bully, and it's on our website today, but it is different because flies sometimes evolve, and this one did. And the first morning that we fished this fly was on the Buffalo River down in the northern part of Arkansas. We were fishing for smallmouth, and I caught a 21-inch smallmouth, which adorns the cover of our smallmouth book. And, of course, the very next day, I realized that I want to get out on the lake and see if this is equally appealing to largemouth bass. And I caught a 20-inch largemouth the very next day on the on Bass Bully. So, yeah, you know, it's always kind of a work in progress, and you make some changes and try to respond to what you think the fish are reacting to. And I love fly design. That's really one of my main interests.
So, again, what was the change from the one in the book to the one?
Well, the one in the book has a twister tail, and the one in the they both have rubber leg collars, which provides a lot of action. But the tail on the modern one is an inverted rabbit strip, which we think does an even better job than the twister tail.
But,
okay.
The last question from Boris was, what is the most unlikely fly that you have taken a largemouth bass on?
Well, Boris, I've got to tell you a little story. This happened to me just last summer. I was fishing a pond in my float tube, and I was not doing well at all and was looking through my fly boxes, and I had tied up some dry flies. And only to see, I wasn't trying to catch fish because they really seemed disinterested and weren't hitting much. Very, very warm night. And I put on a size 16 dry fly to see how it would ride the water. And I cast it in the shade behind a stump. And just as I was getting ready to pick it up, and there might have been just a little bit of movement as I started to lift my rod just the slightest bit, and the pond just opened up. And I caught a bass of maybe 4, 4.5 pounds on a 16 dry. It's not something that I would recommend fishing for a largemouth bass with. Remember, large fly, large meal. But, that was certainly the most unusual fly I've ever caught a largemouth on, I would say.
You know, that's really interesting because when I started, you know, fly fishing with my dad, and we did spin fishing, and started that as early as I could hold a rod. And I didn't really start fly fishing till I was on about eighth grade, and was given a bamboo rod, and then started to learn myself. My dad wasn't a fly fisherman at that time, but the neighbor two doors down was heavily into fly fishing, and he taught my friend and I how to tie flies. So the first fly we ever tied was a mosquito, and probably about a size 16, and that was the first fly I fished on this little bass pond where I caught my first bass. So your unlikely fly was my first fly to catch a bass on. That's kind of funny, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I think again they're so adaptable and whatever happens to be there that they feel is easy, I guess.
And at that time, I didn't know, you know, I wasn't even thinking about, you know, what they should be eating or not eating or any of, you know, I was just trying to catch a fish.
Right.
So that was kind of interesting. Okay, well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come right back and talk more about largemouth bass fishing. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years, and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about the premier shop by logging into their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Terry Wilson about busting largemouth bass. So if you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's dive back in here. Okay, another question. What fly do you use when you have thick weeds? You said they
really love good question.
So, yeah.
And certainly it depends. Seems like all the answers to all the questions are, well, it depends.
Yeah, well, that's fly fishing.
That's fly fishing. But, you know, if you're talking about stringy moss, that's certainly one thing. But if you're talking about leafy vegetation, that's another. I guess the thing that I would use mostly would either be a streamer or our bass bully, the rattle worm certainly, but I would make sure that I was either very confident in the weed guard that I was using, or I might even clip it off and use that stick guard. It's that good. Now, if you're talking stringy moss, I think that your options, you know, are limited. You have to fish little open areas, pockets, in that stringy moss. But any time your fly or your line comes through that, it's going to pick it up, and that's going to be very, very difficult. But even some of the thickest cabbage and any kind of leafy vegetation, you can fish right in that. You need something fairly heavy that's going to that you can pull through those heavy weeds, and you needn't worry about spooking the bass in there. They're used to having things move through their the cover that they are adhering to. And that sound will very often attract them to come and take a look and see what's moving through their environment.
Okay. So that brings up another question about presentation. excuse me. Hold on a second. Had a scratchy throat I had to get rid of there. You know, when you're looking at weed beds, you just mentioned, you know, throwing it right in there, right into the weeds.
Yeah.
I guess my approach had always been, you know, work the edge of the weeds. So
mm-hmm.
really, just anywhere in there, I suppose, they can be. I mean, they're not particular.
Well, you know, it's hard to know what the environment down under is like. The chances are very good that there are holes in the wall, if you will, and that the bass will lay in those holes and appear, you know, and peer out at their environment and will take things that fall down the side. And that's why you find fishing the edges of those weeds so good, so rewarding. On the other hand, there are also open pockets down in the thickest part of the weeds. If I would see an opening in very thick weed growth, then certainly I would throw for that pocket, but I wouldn't be afraid to bring that right through the coontail or whatever type of weed, leafy weed is there, and moving that even in the process, you know, to attract them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Let's see here. We've got, David in Yorba Linda. I know where that is. I spent some time in Loma Linda, which is just up the road from Yorba Linda. Had some big fires in Yorba Linda not too long ago when I was out there as well. David wrote in, I saw your purple Wilson rattleworm fly on your website and was interested in your design features of that fly, long tail, rattle, color. He says, I don't bass fish, but I use something similar for surf fishing in Southern California, for surf perch and halibut. I think this fly works great for fishing perch at sundown because of the dark profile, big footprint, and rattle for low light conditions. So he wants to know, what makes this work so well for bass?
Well, I think actually, David, you've hit it right on the head. I think the dark profile, for one thing, certainly, and it does give a great profile. Also, you mentioned that big footprint, equally important to bass as the fish that you're fishing for in the surf. And then, of course, that rattle, I think, is really an important ingredient. And not only in low light, probably, but as it's hidden by vegetation or by a deadfall or stumps or whatever it might be, it enables the lateral line of the largemouth bass, which works a lot like a sonar, to simply pick up that rattle and hone in on it because it's a sound that occurs in their environment with regularity. You might be interested also, David, that the tail of that is the Edgewater rat tail component, and it really gives great action. I came up with that fly incidentally because I fished with some friends that threw conventional tackle, and I could keep up with them just fine until they started fishing some of the deep structure with plastic worms, and then it became a game of frustration. But you get just as good of action, perhaps better, with that rat tail component tail and with that rattle as they were getting with their plastic worms. And then I felt like I could catch fish for fish with them and hopefully sometimes win the day.
Well, you know, David just opened up a whole new retail opportunity for you.
There you go.
You just need to expand your horizons, Terry, and sell your flies to surf fishermen.
Well, that must be right. I guess, first of all, I better take a trip with David to get some halibut and so forth, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that funny, though? it makes sense, though. I mean, because, you know, the surf fish are very opportunistic and probably feed very much like bass do, you know. What you see, you eat, you know, kind of thing in the ocean.
Yep.
So that's kind of interesting. Well, good. Well, maybe he should try some of your other flies out there and see how they work too. It's going to give a whole new look on the use of the flies.
Well, I'm told by you. Excuse me.
But what you described and David described are really the basics of a lot of designs is, you know, trying to create something that looks alive and looks good to eat and has those elements in it that make that happen for the fish. So,
yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. Let's talk about strategy and tactics more here, dig deeper into that. What do you feel is most effective for reaching largemouth bass? Is it shore fishing, float tube fishing, being out in a boat? Where do you have the most success?
Well, I think all of them have their day and have their times. Given a free choice in the matter, I guess my favorite way to fish would be in a float tube in a pond. It's going to have to be water small enough that I can cover and that I can move about safely without being in danger of somebody's jet ski or something like that. But I love fishing out of a float tube. You're at eye level, and you're moving around quietly. You can get closer to the structure that you're fishing, make short, accurate casts. Lots of advantages, I think, to the float tube. But having said that, I've I've certainly done a lot of shore fishing and a lot of boat fishing, and I don't dislike any of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, along the lines of getting access to the fish. You know, it seems like a float tube. You can kind of work in and out weed beds and so forth.
Yes, and you also get to present from a different angle. If you're shore bound, you know, you can throw deep and retrieve shallow, and you can reverse that if you need to when you're in a float tube, and sometimes that makes all the difference.
Another question here from Scott Rice in Richmond, Virginia. I think we kind of covered this, but maybe you want to add some things, but he said, what's the best time to catch largemouth bass, in your opinion, and how does that compare with what your colleagues are saying? And I'm not sure if he's talking about best time of day or best season here. But maybe you could kind of fill in any gaps that you didn't already talk about.
I think we can address both of those. I guess the best time to catch largemouth by season would have to be spring. Because they're moving shallow for the first time from the winter months, and they are feeding heavily on young of the year minnows, for example, and anything else that they may encounter, and so they're very vulnerable to shallow water casting during that time of year. But I think that the answer to the question is very weather dependent, actually. I think if you are talking about clear water and bright skies, I think you might expect those largemouth to be a lot deeper during the daylight hours, and so you're going to be forced, if you want to fish shallow, into very early and very late fishing, particularly during the summer months. And I think that most bass fishermen probably would be in agreement with us on that. If you're talking about dark conditions, a darkened sky, very cloudy, a little bit of body to the water, which a lot of nutrient enrichment and that sort of thing, then those fish can be shallow, and you really can kind of take a look at that situation, bright as opposed to dark, and make a prediction as to where those fish, in terms of the water column, might be on that particular occasion.
Okay. Quick rewind here. Online question came in from Phil McCartney. California. He said, you must know what kind of fins you prefer for float tube fishing. Anything in particular there?
Well, I think I've used about everything that has hit the market. Back in, I think it was 1970, I got my first belly boat, it was called, and it was a molded plastic job called a Bass Buddy Mini Boat, sold through Cabela's, if I remember right. And it worked very well for a long time until the seam in the seat began to crack and take on water. And when that happened, when I leaned forward, I kept going forward. And when I leaned back, I kept going back. And I tried about every method of resolving the problem that I could. Eventually, I had to discard it and obviously have gone to a whole series of inflatable options. We have five currently, and my favorite, I think, is the U-boat, and for that reason, the force fins that propel you backwards took me a little longer to get onto those, because the force fin, or the fins, I should say, that that came with that original Bass Bully, the fin was on the side of your ankle outside, and as you brought your leg forward, it folded back against your ankle, and as you brought your leg back to push it through the water, it opened and gave resistance. And I liked that really, really well. You couldn't go very fast, but you could be very, very precise with where you were. But, over the years, I've adapted to those force fins just fine, and and that's what I use now.
Okay, okay. Did the largemouth bass cruise at all for prey, or are they always waiting and ambushing?
Well, I refer to them a lot as an ambush predator, and I truly believe that that is the basis of their personality. But on the other hand, I find two situations in which they will cruise, and one of them, or they will deviate from structure, I guess maybe would be a better way to phrase it. If you have a cold front that comes through, let's say we're talking about summer months, and all of a sudden a cold front comes through, and they have been shallow and feeding near the weed beds and so forth, and what will happen with that severe cold front is that they will simply back off, and normally they will back off by going toward the center of the lake, but without changing depth, they will suspend, you know, vertically from, or I should say horizontally from the structure. The other situation where I find that they do a lot of cruising is when there is a specific minnow prey that they are targeting. And often this is what I would call a school bass, between 12 and 15 inches generally. And they, it might be shad, for example, or it might be some other bait fish. But you will actually see the prey break the surface. And here, with the dominant species being shad, we call them shad bursts. And when we see that, certainly we try to get right after them. Now, the problem with it is that you can't cast directly into them because you'll disperse that group really, really rapidly. You need to fish in front of them or behind them or to the side of them. And very often, those 12 to 15-inch fish are pounding the surface shad. And what happens is that there are often shad that are wounded in the process, and they are fluttering down deeper. And to answer that, we have a fly that we call squirrel spin that has a double-aught spinner blade on the back of the fly with the weight at the head. And if you can throw in an area where the 12 to 15 inchers are going to miss it, usually behind the group of marauding bass, and drop that down just a little bit, the bigger bass might be below that, trailing along and picking off all the injured survivors.
Okay, okay. That was my next question is, how do you find the bigger fish? So that's one method.
yeah.
And, cause I sure have caught my share of those, 10, 12 inchers. And, so what are some other techniques, for finding the bigger fish?
Well, as I've stated, more difficult than it sounds because of their penchant for feeding only once every 4 or 5 days. Having said that, you know, they are like other species of fish in that the bigger bass are going to occupy the very best lie. And usually what that means is the heaviest brush, the heaviest weed bed, the most inaccessible places to cast, way back in under the dock where it's heavily shaded, and there's a couple of Christmas trees that the owner of the cabin nearby has placed there, and so forth. So I think you look, you have to look without a locator. That makes a very big difference, certainly. But if you are wanting to target the larger fish, use larger flies and fish the most difficult lies. I think that would be the most straightforward information I could probably give there.
Okay. And have luck on your side, right?
That always helps.
Always,
yeah.
Have. do you ever have an opportunity to sight for bass? And if so, are there any indicators that tell you that a fish is working an area? I mean, you just mentioned the shad. That could be something you could see a fish busting on.
Yeah. Yeah, there's certain times of the year, particularly on the large reservoirs, where there are just clouds of bait fish. And you can, particularly as you're standing or sitting on the front seat of a bass boat, for example, and you're looking out over the water, and it's relatively calm, and you can see that dark, almost shadowy, cloudy looking movement to those bait fish. And sometimes those are baby catfish, and other times they're, you know, some other species altogether. But one thing that you can know is that while there might not be any bass actively pursuing them, running through them, chasing them to the surface, you can bet your bottom dollar that there are big bass nearby. So where is the nearest good cover where they might be in a position to ambush a group like that? The outside edge of a stump line or tree line or brush line or weed line, for example, is usually a very good place to find them.
So in that, let me see if I'm reading you right here. If this school of baitfish is passing by their lair there, then that's an opportunity for them to attack those baitfish. But will they actually, you know, you had mentioned earlier following below, maybe picking off wounded and so forth. So will they actually follow that group of baitfish around and leave their lairs, or are they always going to stick by that structure?
Well, I find that most of the time, I really can't think of any exception to it, although there may be, the times that I have observed this have been in coves. And so consequently, it's kind of a confined area to start with. And if you let's say that you have a line of deep stumps on one side of the cove and heavy vegetation maybe on the other side, and you've got kind of a narrow channel down the middle, and I don't know how narrow might be, but nonetheless, it's not wide open, you know, lake water, and so within that confine, I think that you're going to find those larger specimens lying in wait. If they're not actively pursuing them, they're certainly waiting for an easier opportunity to feed without expending much energy.
Yeah, I mentioned this on some other shows. We were up in Canada fishing for pike, huge lake. I think it's 250 acres or something like that. There was the weather was blowing in, and a kind of a little rainstorm had come in, and it was blowing our boat and all the water into this cove. And so our guide took us into that cove, and it was kind of like you said, it was a confined area, not a lot of structure around, but it had pushed the bait fish in there, and the pike were just slamming these things, and
yes,
the bait fish were flying up in the air because the pike were underneath chasing them around. And so that was kind of, you know, what I was thinking about is, you know, is that a situation,
yep,
that bass might take advantage of too?
So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly the way a bass would feed, that's for sure.
Okay. Let's take another quick break, and then we'll finish off the rest of the night with talking more about largemouth bass. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rod? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques, stories about fishing bamboo rods, to rod-maker profiles, to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Terry Wilson about busting largemouth bass. If you'd like to ask Terry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Speaking of which, let's see what we got here. When you, Larry Hall in Indian River, Michigan, some good bass fishing up there.
Yep.
When you are not finding fish, what is the thought process and sequence you go through to find them?
alluded to this just a little earlier. To me, it's all about the light. If I'm not finding the fish, I need to reevaluate, what the light is doing and how and what kind of an effect it's having on the bass. Bright or light conditions, they're going to be deeper. Dark conditions, dark water, dark sky, etc., they're going to be higher in the water column. Now, with that having been said, when there are when you're having a difficult time locating them, consider how often that light condition is changing. The most difficult condition for Roxanne and I is the I would say when the sun is playing hide and seek in the clouds. It becomes a case where it's dark for a while and the fish may feel like they can move up and feed a little more shallow, and then all of a sudden here's the sun again, and so they drop back down. And I think that they're not going to do that very many times before they just say, that's enough, I'm just going to find a comfortable place to stay and we'll wait this out, and when it gets completely dark I'll go ahead and feed. And so that's our most difficult condition, is that dancing in among the clouds. But certainly I think that that fish location, bass location, has most to do with that sunlight penetration.
That's interesting. I never thought of that in and out days, because I'm sure that affects a lot of different kinds of fish, not just bass, but
yes,
probably trout and just about everything.
Yeah.
So it makes that fishing in the middle of the day all that much harder most of the time.
Well, you're just going to have to fish deeper. I mean, that's the bottom line on it.
Yeah. Get down there. Yeah, good. Okay, let's see if we got any more from online. John Gilbert, Spokane, Washington, says, I just bought a fishing kayak that you can stand up in. I plan on trying it as a tool for many forms of freshwater fish. What do you think on this method of fly fishing for bass?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I wish I had a good kayak that you could stand up in and guess. I like the idea a lot. I've got to tell you a real quick story. I've got a friend down in Texas, a good bass fisherman and an excellent fly tier. He was raised in South Louisiana, and he said to me one day a couple of years back, he said, I would like for you to be able to tell me why. When I was a kid, I could stand on my piro and with one foot on each gunwale, and I could pole through those bayous all day long and never tip or be in any way threatened that I was going to fall out. Now I get in my kayak, I take a deep breath, and if one lung fills with more air than the other, I tip over.
So, I'll get old.
Yeah, that was his take on kayak fishing. But, it's very much like a float tube, only you have a little bit more mobility. You can get there quicker, get there farther away. You can even use motorized if you were to need to or want to. It's a wonderful way to fish.
Well, and the newer ones are really designed for that, and for standing up.
That's right.
It a lot easier than the early versions of that. So they've come a long way with those designs.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends that fish from kayaks, and the one thing that has always disappointed me just a little bit is they have methods of holding casting and spinning rods in as you're traveling, but they haven't made much of a provision for fly rods, and I wish that they would apply a little bit more thought to that. But it's certainly a growing segment of our fishing population, no doubt.
Yeah. Okay, another question here. Eric in Avondale, Pennsylvania, wrote in, and he says, Terry, largemouth bass are often found in parts of waterways that are thick with grass, lily pads, or underwater brush. It is one thing to handle those obstacles with a medium-heavy bait casting rod, braided line, and sturdy treble hooks. How do you effectively fish these areas with fly tackle?
Well, the same way, I guess. The first advice would be to heavy up on your leader and tippet strength a good deal. Certainly in that kind of an environment, they're not going to be leader shy whatsoever. And then be very aggressive in moving your fly through that heavy vegetation. But also use the very best weed guard system that you can come up with. And very often I'm very comfortable with particularly a double weed guard that is pretty sturdy. If I'm fishing a large bait, I like that just fine. But remember those stick guards. You're just going to be surprised. The first night that I fished those, I attached them to a fly, and I would just throw it up over a dock and you know, try to retrieve the fly. The only time that I didn't get the fly back is when it wedged, you know, between two pieces of wood. Other than that, it always came back to me. And I really came to believe in that a lot. It's a product I really think that fly fishers should be increasingly aware of and utilize. And I think there's a couple different companies that make them. Can't even really tell you which ones they are. But look, at, like I say, in the conventional aisle of tackle stores and ask for them by name, and you'll come up
with
them.
And the name is, again, just?
Yeah, Stick Guard, S-T-I-C-K. G-U-A-R-D.
Okay. Now, you didn't find those or the other monofilament weed guards that you use. Those don't seem to interfere with the bite with largemouth bass?
Well, the heavier the vegetation and the larger the fly, the less I think that it's affected by that weed guard. If I had a clear choice in the matter, I would certainly not use it, because do I think that it's possible that fish may pick that up and kind of feel that that weed guard and drop it? I think that's possible. To place a percentage on it, I think, would be really, really difficult. But sometimes we just absolutely have no choice. It's just like Eric pointed out, you know, sometimes they're in the thickest part. And, you know, how do we fish that? Well, I think that we have to fish it with the same mindset that that the bait caster uses.
Okay.
And thank you for that question, Eric. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Another question from Chris in Brentwood, California. He says, when do you fish topwater and when do you fish streamers or subsurface? When nothing is biting but conditions seem good, what do you do then?
Well, again, light penetration, Chris, is really the key as to when you're going to fish top and when you're going to fish bottom. If given a clear choice in the matter, the most fun fishing for largemouth that I do is in darkened conditions, heavily shaded, where I can throw something on top without a weed guard, pull it under and let it float back up to the top. We tie a fly called hula diver that is much fun to fish, because those legs keep wiggling after the floater diver floats back to the surface. And I truly enjoy doing that. But we have to realize that, like most other species, bass feed subsurface 90% of the time. Virtually. And so we have to be prepared to go down, and often that means going into some very, very heavy stuff, and we have to be ready to, weed guards to come through it.
I wonder if that answers the next question, which is, again, Boris in Ohio. He sent in a lot of questions tonight. We appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you, Boris.
He said, if you were limited to one fly and one presentation for largemouth bass, what would you choose? Would that be a hula diver in a dark, cozy corner?
Well, if depends on a lot of other factors, Boris. Actually, if we've got calm conditions, low light, heavy cloud cover, lots of shade, that kind of situation, yeah, I'd love to throw that hula diver. But if I have only one fly and one presentation for largemouth bass, what would it be? I'd have to say that I would choose my bass bully, which is a jig-type fly. It has a lot of rubber legs with it provides a lot of action and that rabbit strip tail that that projects a lot of action also. And I would use the lift drop strip retrieve with that because that's how you're going to maximize that action. So thank you for that question. That's an excellent question, and that would be what I would use.
Yeah, the next question is very similar. Mike in Northern Virginia says, if you had only one bass, find one strategy to use a largemouth bass in early or late evening daylight hours on a lake. So would that change things up, early morning or late evening?
Well, I think it raises the opportunity, raises the chances of being able to fish that surface fly.
Right.
You know, if you again relatively calm conditions and once again heavy darkness, overcast, a little bit of maybe darkness in the water, nutrient enrichment, and that sort of thing, then yeah, I think then I would have to go to a bass bully or something like that, unless I could get by with throwing something on the surface, and those conditions
right.
would be, you know, facilitated even more.
Right, right. Any do's and don'ts you can tell us about fighting bass? Once you get hooked up, how do you stay hooked up? Any tips there?
Well, I think most people make the mistake of trying to land the bass too quickly. Try to horse them in, and that rarely is a good idea. We see a lot of that on television with the bait casting pros and that sort of thing that kind of water ski them maybe across the top. And with that long, flexible fly rod, that really is not a good option. Take your time, and I like to use the angles of the rod to cause the fish to try to swim in the direction that we want. And I mean by that to lower the rod and to give him an angle from the side, excuse me, give him an angle from the side and cause him to try to swim away from that in the opposite direction. Very often you can entice the bass into going for open water instead of the nearby entanglements by doing that. But take your time and, you know, play him out. You don't need to exhaust the fish. He doesn't need to roll over on his side or his belly or anything like that. But certainly by hurrying him, you're going to lose more fish than you catch.
Yeah, Pete Parker, who was on our show, and he's since passed away, but he was a big saltwater fly fisher, and I think he used to call, you know, that keeping the rod low and at an angle, the down and dirty technique.
good description.
Yeah, to keep the pressure on the fish, especially larger fish. One last question, and then we'll call it a night. What about handling the fish? You mentioned you see on TV. And, you know, I kind of cringe when I see those bass tournaments and they're just hauling those fish in like they do.
Yeah, exactly.
But from a fly fisherman, and we're a little bit more sensitive than the bait fisherman, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I sure
like
to think
so.
Yeah.
How do you handle a bass when you get them in your...
Well, ideally, I'd like to, if I'm in a boat or a float tube, I'd like to play him close so that I can reach down and lip him. That is to say, grab his lower jaw and kind of thrust his tongue forward. You don't need to be, it's not a feat of strength, but that seems to disable him a bit. And take your fly from it without removing the bass from the water and release him right there. If you are in a situation where you're forced to bring the bass to, you know, out of the water, then make sure that your hand is wet and, you know, dip your hand in the water before you grab a hold of the fish, because what happens is the acid in your hands really erodes the protective slime on the fish, and they're real susceptible to disease and bacteria and that sort of thing. So, I you know, it's a resource that we can protect and that we can hopefully, you know, keep, you know, the quality of our sport high, and that's one way we can do it.
And the lipping, as you describe it, doesn't seem to hurt the fish or anything?
No, no.
Okay. Okay, good, good. Good to know. Well, we're out of time, Terry. Need to wrap things up here. We are going to do a few more things before the night ends, so stick with me, Terry, and we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and that largemouth bass sampler, fly sampler that you and Roxanne offered up, 16 flies right from the Wilsons. So let's do that. Just one more thing to do before we get into that, and so stick with me, everyone. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org, or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on that link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now's a time to give away our prizes. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. Now, if you didn't register for that for tonight's show, you're too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so you don't miss a chance at some of the great prizes we have to give away. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show by email to tell you how you can redeem your, or to receive your gift, I should say, and how we can take care of that for you. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and the Federation is a great organization to support, and they are international and cover both warm, cold, and salt water. So great organization to look into. FedFlyFishers.org, FedFlyFishers.org. So let's see if we have a winner for that. And that would be Walt Cole. That sounds familiar. I think maybe Walt's won before out in California. So, Walt, I'll get you a one-year membership to the Federation. Fly Fishers, if you do have a membership, we can get that extended. So we'll be contacting you regarding that, and congratulations. Also, we're giving away a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. And you can find out more about all the books that Amato has at amatobooks.com. And our winner there is Sam Brown in Ohio. Sam Brown in Ohio. So congratulations, Sam. And I know you'll enjoy that publication as well. So, and I believe, Terry, are all your books published through Amato?
All but one, yes.
Okay, okay. So you may be see the Wilson's books out there as well. On the Amato site when you're poking around out there. Okay, now, time to give away Terry and Roxanne's largemouth bass fly sampler, 16 bass flies right from the vices of the Wilsons. And you need to answer a question. So let me clear my queue real quick here, make sure I don't have anybody in there already. Did I win? Okay, somebody wrote in, did I win? Did I win what? We haven't done anything yet. Okay, so the question here is, What was the name of the fly that we talked about of Terry's design that was used in Southern California for surf perch and halibut? What was the name of that fly? You have to get the color right, but if you get the name of the fly right, we'll give you this selection of bass flies. So that then you know you can take the bass flies to Southern California and do just fine. So let's see. That might be too hard, but if somebody was taking notes, might get this one. Nope. First one came in, Terry. It wasn't the bass bully, was it?
Nope.
It wasn't that one. That was a popular one. Oh, another one, bass bully. Wasn't the bass bully. So that's two wrong answers. You guys need to try again, and we'll see what we get here. I think this might be close enough, except you didn't give me your name, so I have no idea who won, but just somebody just gave me the right answer but didn't put their name in there, so. Okay, here we got one, and Dean Wormell has won. Wilson Rattleworm, and I think that was the fly, wasn't it, Terry?
That's correct. That's the one.
Yeah, so Dean, congratulations on winning that, and we'll get Dean, I know you've won before. Please send me over your address again because I don't keep those on file, and so that we can get that sent out to you directly from Terry and Roxanne's shop down there. So congratulations, Dean, and that one was a little tougher, so that's good. That can't be too easy on these things, and so that's good to go on that. Well, Terry, thanks so much for being on the show again with us. I think we've got another show to do at some time down the road. Talk about bluegill, right? And maybe we can do another show on that sometime.
Well, that sure sounds great. It's been my pleasure, Roger. I've enjoyed it. And thanks to all the guys that sent in questions. I really appreciate that also.
Yeah, we had an active group tonight and lots of fun, as always. So, well, good to have you on, and hope we can talk to you again sometime.
Absolutely.
Well, hopefully, everybody, you found the archive on our website. If you haven't, there's a couple links on it, to it at the bottom of our homepage and the bottom of every page, in fact. Done over 180 shows in our archive now. You'll find shows on just about anything from trout to tarpon to the Madison River to surf fishing in California to you name it. So explore our archive and learn a lot about fly fishing. We've got a lot of other experts like Terry that have done shows in the past, and I know you'll find it enjoyable. Our next broadcast will be on April 16th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and in that show I'm going to interview Richard Palatsky, and our topic for the show will be the seasons of stillwater, and specifically in the Rocky Mountains. Richard's expertise is in high mountain stillwater fly fishing. He'll be talking with us about the stillwater fishing seasons in the Rocky Mountain region, detailing what the conditions will be, what hatches occur, and the best methods to fish at that time of year. So join us to get dialed into high mountain stillwater fly fishing on April 16th. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.